This is Asia Bogdanoff, the online community manager at TED.com, and you are listening to the Social Media Clarity Podcast.
This is not the first time that we've had a lag between the disruptive effects of a new communication medium and the norms and mechanisms that arise to deal with that.
Welcome to the Social Media Clarity Podcast. 15 minutes of concentrated analysis and advice about social media in platform and product design.
Welcome to the Social Media Clarity Podcast. I'm Randy Farmer.
I'm Scott Moore.
And I'm Mark Smith.
I'm Howard Reingold.
This week's news is that Mark and I both have new papers out. Mine is a new white paper entitled Five Questions for Selecting an Online Community Platform. There's a link to get the PDF in the episode show notes. While there are numerous books, blogs, and white papers out there to help community managers grow and manage their communities, there's no true guide to how to pick the right infrastructure for your community, especially when you've never done it before. Ning.com asked me to help them put together a platform-agnostic guide to making the right choice in a complicated marketplace with competing claims and features. It is truly the first guide of its kind, and we're happy to share it with you. It's 19 pages long, but don't worry. Much of that is callouts and workbook formatting to make it easy to go through the process. If you like your insight in smaller chunks, the paper will also be serialized over the coming weeks on the Cultivating Community blog, so you might want to subscribe.
My news this week, our new report from the Pew Research Internet Project and the Social Media Research Foundation. The report is entitled Mapping Twitter Topic Networks from Polarized Crowds to Community Clusters. In this report, we show six different types of social media network patterns that are distinct and commonly found in social media platforms like Twitter. I invite other people to take a look at the report at pewinternet.org. I hope you'll find it useful.
Today we interview Howard Reingold, a critic, writer, and teacher specializing in the cultural, social, and political implications of modern communications media, such as the internet, mobile, and virtual communities. He is the author of several books, Tools for Thought, The Virtual Community, Smart Mobs, and NetSmart.
So Howard, in your classes, what kinds of issues are coming up as most present?
Well, the issues of identity are big for young people, and it's interesting that the rate at which their attitudes are mutating. Because I was in the classroom at Stanford when Facebook was on, I think, Harvard, Princeton, and Stanford. So it was very new, and it was a radical shift for students in order to know who each other are. You can pretty much stalk everybody in your classroom instantaneously. That was never really available before. And I was there 4 years later when the first graduates who had been using Facebook throughout their Stanford career were faced by the prospect of not getting into graduate school or not getting the job they wanted because of their drunken Facebook photos. That issue first arose during that first class who had been through 4 years of Facebook, and it has not gone away. So how do we conduct this kind of impression management online? To what degree do we have control over what people think of us? And to what degree have the media wrested a lot of that control away from us? And what are we going to do about it? And I'll have to say that I'm seeing a shift in enthusiasms, that more and more students are more and more critical of the role of social media in their lives. And particularly Facebook, it very rapidly became necessary to be on Facebook. You really weren't a college student unless you were on Facebook. And now I'm seeing more and more students who are deleting their Facebook accounts, or they do what they started to do when they were in high school, which is they will shut down their Facebook account when they're not on Facebook. So we're seeing strategies emerging from students who aren't particularly getting these from college classrooms, but we're seeing these issues emerge when we're having discussions about what social media mean. I think that we're seeing, if not a maturing, a broadening of the interests of young people about what social media is doing to them.
We've been talking a lot about how even if you try to selectively share which may be one of the requirements to create community, the sense that there's stuff inside the boundary that isn't going to be outside the boundary. That very capacity in information technology may be eroding, that it's not possible anymore to selectively share, because we know that all forms of privacy can be eroded.
We are already in a world of collision. If you call in sick, your boss better not see you Instagramming your pics from the ski slopes. We used to be able to create boundaries between our work life and our home life, or the life our kids see of us and the life that our adult friends see of us. With all of this self-reporting and the ability to aggregate it, we are enabling people to know what we're doing all the time. We don't really have any kind of institutional or informal social means of educating people about the choices that the technologies that are available confront us with. I'm very interested in norms and social behavior and learning in regard to the social collisions that are caused by the entrance of this ubiquitous surveillance technology into our social lives. You know, I think all of us were among the very few people who were concerned about where surveillance technology, data surveillance technology was going 15 years ago or more. Nobody really cared. There was not really any citizen response to those who warned where things were going. I think it's too late to do anything about the technology. And it's probably too late to do anything about the political regulation of technology. I mean, we're seeing that play out with the NSA revelations and the response to it. But what we do have control over is what we know and how we behave. So I wrote my book, NetSmart, How to Thrive Online, published in 2012. Precisely because we've got a huge population of a couple of billion people have internet access, and only a tiny fraction of them are really aware of the ramifications of their behavior. So why don't we start with enabling people to understand what it means when they share and what control they have over it, and the ways in which they do have some agency over shaping the way they appear to others. This is not the first time that we've had a lag between the disruptive effects of a new communication medium and the norms and mechanisms that arise to deal with that. You know, we've had writing and the printing press and the telephone before. I think that this is something different. It's much larger. It's much more powerful. It's happening much more rapidly. But I think the same issue applies, which is that there's a period between when the technology enables all kinds of new enterprises, new behaviors, new social and political arrangements, and the spread of illiteracy about how to do it. But Mark, you remember we were talking in 2000 about the way that the intersection of the mobile device, the internet, and the PC were lowering barriers to collective action. And we were seeing signals like the texting revolution in the Philippines and the activists using online media to coordinate in real time during the World Trade Organization demonstrations in Seattle in 1999. It took 10 years for the Egyptian activists to use Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. Why? I think primarily it had to do with the spread of the literacy about how to do that. These things are happening very, very rapidly, and I think some people are not keeping up, some people are rejecting, and some people are beginning to create kind of social boundaries. Norms and etiquette are culturally related. Maybe we'll see the Chinese and the Japanese and the Indonesians and the North Americans and the Brazilians evolving different norms, or maybe we're seeing a kind of global culture in which what we now consider to be rude won't be considered rude by anybody in the future. We don't really know.
Thank you for talking to us today, Howard. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been fun for me as well.
Yes, thanks, Howard.
Thanks, Howard.
I watched your promotional video for NetSmart, and it promised concrete advice about how to navigate social media successfully instead of just being afraid of it. And so I'd like to ask, do you have some specific advice that you could share as a tip for our listeners?
Okay, well, there are a number of tips. Some of them I think are pretty simple. Nevertheless, a lot of people could benefit by paying attention to them. And I'll start with what I think is the most important and perhaps the simplest, which is what I call crap detection. We live in an age where you can get the answer to any question. You can get it pretty much anywhere. You can get many answers to any question, and you can do it within a second or two. But now it's up to you, the person who asks the question, to figure out which of those answers is accurate, which of them is misinformation, bad information, or disinformation. One really simple thing that I taught my daughter, look for an author. And if you find an author, search on that author's name and see what other people have to say about that author. You can't trust everything that everybody says about someone, but it's usually pretty revealing, particularly when you're looking up a claim of scientific or scholarly information and medical information. I think another thing is to think about the personal learning network. We now have the ability to put together collections of information sources and pay attention to people to learn about just about anything we want to learn in ways that never were possible before. But if you are interested in learning digital video and any other expertise or any other field, you could go onto Twitter, you could do a little search, and you could find some people who know what they're talking about and follow them. And you could find out who they are following and follow those people. And you could make a list of experts in that field. You know, that brings up the issue of social capital. You know, that kind of everyday reciprocity of information sharing that you see on Twitter and elsewhere. In the short run, it may seem insignificant or even trivial, but what you're doing is you're building those networks of trust and norms of reciprocity from which social capital emerges. And I can demonstrate this for my students anytime by asking a question on Twitter or Facebook at the beginning of class, and then towards the end of the class, going back and seeing what people have to say. Well, I get a lot of answers. I got a lot of answers because I have a pretty big network, and that has a lot to do with me being online so much and with sharing a lot online. But I also get answers because I answer other people when they have questions as well. I get information that way all the time from people I've not connected with before, and some of it's very useful, and I thank them for it. And they have started engaging me, and I engage them back, because what you put out to your network can come back to you 100-fold. So I think those are all things that don't require a lot of technical expertise that any user of social media would benefit by using.
For links, transcripts, and more episodes, go to socialmediaclarity.net. Thanks for listening.